Greetings. Welcome to the Storytime Broadcast. I'm Eric Bra, and each episode I read a story, and with the help of 3-Pound Magician, we hope to entertain you. The stories vary in style, some happy, some sad, and some might be like this story, a bit scary and gross. This time we travel back to the turn of the 20th century in Peru, along the Amazon River. Written by Corey Hill and sound designed by Frank Sladisco. Here is Amazonas. Amazonas, Peru, 1908. The engine stopped 2 days downriver of Iquitos. Imelda stirred. She opened the door to her cabin and emerged onto the deck, leaning against the railing. From the crew members below came muffled shouts, followed by rhythmic clanking of the chain, and then a great splash as the anchor penetrated the murk. The air saturated here. Leaves, water, the coils of smell from organic matter alive and rotting. Heavy, rich, roiling and settling, furling and unfurling. Insects and jaguars and turtles churning in the dirt, and then dragged by tangled roots and carried on the swollen vein of brown water out to sea somewhere thousands of miles distant. A man in a crisp white coat bearing a tray of champagne flutes appeared.
"Please accept our apologies. We'll be on our way again soon," he sang.
Nearby, three passengers clustered in a wrap of tobacco smoke. Europeans, likely English. Accountants from the main office, first-time visitors, as evidenced by the pale, almost translucent skin and the fact that their woolen clothes were wholly unsuited to the climb, drooping, as were their pasty faces, their freckled noses and baby pink ears, all slumping towards the deck. The manner with which the short, fat woman pointed aggressively with the glowing point of her cigarette indicated that she simply could not believe the inconvenience. Even the humidity and the heat were somehow contrived as irritants for her and her alone. Imelda went in the opposite direction, seeking to avoid the noisome smoke. She asked the porter within the lounge if there was any fruit on board, but there was nothing other than cured meats and cheeses, he said. The porter then poured himself a glass of whiskey and shrunk from view behind the bar, repeating, "Meats and cheeses, meats and cheeses." A man wearing a large black hat reached up and tapped her on the wrist.
"You look like one of them," said the man.
"One of who?" Imelda asked.
"The natives, the goddamn savages," he said.
Rather than bring up her mother, rather than refute him, rather than break the man's tumbler and jam a shard into his bulbous toad throat, she said,
"I'm often told that."
"They're beautiful people, you know, but not like you and me," the man said.
"How's that?" Imelda asked.
"They're like children in a way, easy to fool, quick to anger," said the man.
"Have you met many of them?" she asked.
"Unfortunately, yes, I have. Visiting the plantations from time to time to see how production is coming along. I can't help but see them. Simply pitiable, the way they dress, unashamed by the grotesque immodesty of their nakedness. I do think there is some redemption for them in hard work," he said.
"I hope so," she said, and then returned to her room. She slept, but not well. Without the steady strum of the engines to negate the other passengers, the small room was beset on all sides by bodiless voices and the sound of feet upon the deck. It was dusk, and the boat had still not moved. The Europeans were arranged in the same place as before, unsteady, wavering, beneath their feet a constellation of broken glass from the numerous champagne flutes they'd dropped. Rindles of orange and red cloud across the sky. The short, fat woman climbed the railing and began squawking. Her companions laughed, tobacco smoke spurting from their nostrils as they did so. The short, fat woman called louder, flapping her arms, cawing, swaying dangerously. Then, the woman fell into the water, making enough of a splash that Imelda was forced to wipe the Amazon from her own face with her kerchief. The European woman's companions swayed and peered over the railing but made no move to help her. Imelda leaned over the railing and saw the woman struggling in the water below. One of the deckhands appeared, looked over the railing, and then made a notation within a small notebook he carried. "We cannot go in after her," the man said to the Europeans. They shrugged and resumed their conversation. The woman drowned quickly anyway, so there was not much in the way of interruption. The deckhand peered over the railing in confirmation, making another mark in his notebook once her shouting stopped completely. The champagne ran low, so on the next pass, the porter bore a bottle of brandy, which the Europeans grabbed from the tray and drank without the aid of glasses, pouring the dark liquid mostly into their mouths, but also onto the front of their woolen clothing. Imelda glanced over the railing, but the woman's body was no longer there. Sometime later, an indigo darkness enveloped the ship, and at last the captain was seen walking slowly. "The radio is not working," he said. He launched a flare. "I don't have much hope anyone will see this." He walked away. Imelda once again entered the lounge to see if she could find something to eat. "Is there any fruit in there?" Imelda asked the porter. He did not respond. He was cradling an empty bottle of champagne, and bubbles of spit frothed from his mouth as if he were a crab. Another passenger followed behind her and began opening all of the cabinets. He found a container full of cured meats and began eating them with some prejudice. Imelda watched, transfixed, as he ate the entire container within 3 minutes, then rolled to the ground and began groaning. Yet another passenger entered the lounge. "Any food in here?" he asked. Possibly, Imelda said. The second passenger examined the sleeping porter, the groaning man, and then began opening the cabinets. Finding them empty, he accosted the groaning man. "Why did you eat everything? I am starving! Tell me where the other food is!" he shouted. He then kicked the man in the stomach, but this did not produce an answer. "Tell me where the other food is!" the hungry man continued to shout, all the while stomping and kicking the other man. Imelda paced, and the darkness multiplied in all directions. The banks disappeared, the clouds above as well. On the lower deck, many of the passengers were clawing one another. The deck was slick and crimson. A tall man with a mustache fell to the ground, and a crowd of shouting men and women fell upon him. Soon, Imelda heard a crunch, and she knew the tall man was dead. The other passengers commenced to eating his flesh. Imelda ran in the opposite direction and screamed when she collided into something. "Excuse, please, please come with me," said the captain in English with a thick accent she could not place. He pointed to a small lifeboat in which sat the rubber baron and one of the porters. She heard a grunt from the captain and turned to see that he was wrestling with one of the other passengers whose face was covered in blood. The captain pulled a pistol from his shirt coat pocket and placed it against the temple of the man, and then pulled the trigger. The passenger's skull ruptured like an overripe mango. The captain removed a kerchief and wiped pieces of passenger from the end of his pistol. Then she and the captain boarded the smaller craft, untied the ropes, and slid away into the darkness. The screams receded. The lights receded, everything. And there was no moon, no moonlight, only the sound of the oars breaking the water. Not even a bird or an insect. It was the lifeboat alone in a great black wash. Naturally, she thought of Iquitos. Iquitos was an ugly city of horse manure and dust.
In Iquitos, she had been unhappy. Consequently, drifting in this blackness was superior to another minute spent in the city where her mother had died. The money to pay for her passage had taken years to accumulate, and she had nothing beyond it. Wherever she arrived, she would be penniless. She had nothing worth taking from the small room she rented in Iquitos, so the loss of the boat did not change much for her ultimate trajectory. Not really, only a slight diversion. She trailed her finger in the warm water, aware of the snakes, aware of the crocodiles, aware of the biting fish, and the thousand other monsters trawling unseen, but unconcerned they anymore had any power over her. She was born in Iquitos, and she had thought she would die there, and her body burned without so much as another person to take possession of her ashes. She was troubled most days by the certainty that beneath the flesh of many of those walking towards the brothel, towards the bank, towards the telegraph, towards the saloon, were rusty mechanisms and great empty pouches. She was troubled other days by the depth of blackness in the eyes of the horses. In Iquitos, there were few people who looked like her. Most of the people like her were somewhere else, either in villages she knew not how to reach, or trapped on plantations, tapping the trees under the whip of the overseers. She ventured her entire hand up to her elbow into the warm water. The captain watched her do so, but made no move to try and stop her. His face was speckled with the blood of the passenger he'd shot before they boarded the lifeboat. In Iquitos, she could not help but think of her mother and remember the scar on her mother's nose that a man from Spain had inflicted on Christmas Eve with a broken whiskey bottle. Her mother said it was nothing and that he was still a good man. In Iquitos, there was an opera house, but Imelda did not have enough money for the opera. Iquitos was an ugly place, and she did not feel at home there, even though she had never left it until 2 days prior. The boat receded, everything, and then there was nothing. Everything in the entire world save for this craft, and Imelda felt the warm water passing across her fingers and determined that it was just as well. The lifeboat stopped, and the rubber baron pushed the porter out of the way to jump onto the shallow bank. The captain made a small fire, and they arranged themselves around the heat and light, saying nothing as their shadows undulated across the sand and black water. The sun rose, and they discovered that there were numerous dwellings, wooden homes built on stilts within just meters from where they'd landed. Without a word, the captain roused and walked towards the houses. A woman emerged from one of the homes. The woman was wearing a simple skirt woven from plants and nothing else. Something in her movements, in the color and consistency of her skin and hair, loosed a tiny fluttering bird in Imelda's ribcage. The woman looked a great deal like Imelda, like Imelda's mother. The woman was pregnant.
Hey! We're in need of assistance. Our ship fell into a bad way and we were forced to abandon. We need water, food, said the captain.
With hand gestures, she invited them to follow her, and she led them to a small fire over which was suspended a modest metal pot filled with clear broth and fish. From a mat, the woman retrieved 4 bowls, which she filled with stew and handed them to the 4 travelers. Imelda sipped, watched the woman, tiny wings in her sternum flickering across the edges of her lungs. Just before Imelda finished her stew, bright filigree notes drifted through the air. Imelda had heard this instrument before, somewhere, sometime with her mother, but the memory was indistinct. The fold of a purple dress, the sweet sweat smell of her mother's neck, a candle, the youthful certainty that there is an untapped reservoir of future warmth. Steadily, the sound grew, and in turn, the pregnant woman's eyes widened, and she erupted into a gigantic smile. The pregnant woman rose and gestured for them to follow her to the water's edge. There, cutting cleanly through the water, a long, slender canoe moving towards the shore with no apparent means of propulsion. At the bow, a beautiful brown-skinned man wearing a multicolored coat patched together with animal skins and furs, his head covered in a great cap, his face red with the exertion of playing the long wooden instrument wedged into his lips. His canoe beached. He bowed, removed the flute from his lips, and jumped to shore. The pregnant woman ran to greet him, and he embraced her and placed his hands on her swollen belly. He said something in a language none but the pregnant woman could understand, but the cadence was unmistakably one of great tenderness. He did not at all appear surprised by the appearance of four strangers.
"Hey, we are in need of help. We were forced ashore, and we may be lost," said the captain.
The brown-skinned man clapped his hands together and said something to the captain in rough, halting tongue. The captain was confused for a moment, then broke out in guttural laughter. The man in the hat then turned to Imelda. He spoke to her fluently in a language she hadn't heard in many years, the language her mother spoke to her as a child.
"I hear you have experienced some misfortune," he said.
"Yes," she said.
"But with your person all in one piece, that is wonderful," he said.
"Yes," she said.
"You were lucky, very lucky to have gone ashore where you did. There's nothing near here, and not many ships come this way. Very lucky to have found my water lily. Very fortunate," he said.
His voice pitched much like a woodwind instrument he'd played upon his arrival. Beneath his jacket, the man wore nothing, and his skin was smooth, almost shiny.
"Will you help us?" Imelda asked.
"I will do what I can. That's all I can do, right? That's all I can do. That's all I can do. But maybe I can do more than some others. Who is to say? I enjoy not knowing. That's a great big part of it, isn't it?" he said.
"I have had my fill of not knowing," said Imelda.
"Ah, well, not knowing and knowing? Hard to know which is which until much later. That's what I think. But I will do what I can in any case to help. Help, assist. Perhaps even amuse, if there is time. We shall see. We shall see."
"And what is your name?" Imelda asked.
"The visitor," he said.
"Imelda," she said.
"And her name?" Imelda asked, nodding towards the pregnant woman.
"I call her my water lily, but her name is Kachiri."
"She is your wife?"
"Oh, well, no, but also not no. What to say about my water lily? She is my everything, but I have many everythings," he said.
The visitor kissed her on her forehead. A current passed through her forehead into her chest cavity, squirming electricity down to her loins. She suppressed a shudder. He placed his hands on both sides of her face, and his fingertips smelled faintly of soil and salt water. She involuntarily reached out to place her hand on his shiny chest, but he stood and walked away and left her with a small bundle of excitement stored within her person for which she could foresee no immediate means of dispersal. The visitor then greeted the Rubber Baron in English. The Rubber Baron removed and tipped his hat. The visitor bowed theatrically. The visitor and the Rubber Baron conversed for some time, but Imelda could see that the Rubber Baron was still in a foul mood at the conclusion of the conversation. He stomped the ground and jabbed his fat fist angrily in the visitor's face. The visitor placed his hands on the Rubber Baron's shoulders, who then brushed them aside. The visitor bowed deeply with even greater theatricality. The Rubber Baron made a dismissive gesture with his hands. The visitor laughed loudly. Kachiri beckoned for the visitor, who took his leave. The Rubber Baron huffed and sat down on a tree stump. Kachiri and the visitor disappeared into her home. A red and orange bird crossed the sky. Imelda absorbed the contraction of the jungle, swum in warmth and wetness. She watched as the captain moved items back and forth from the dwellings to the boat, gathering empty containers, sticks, sundry items. She watched as the porter found a place to lay down his body and slept. The configuration of all things had shifted in a way that slowed all movements, or if not slowed,
then miniaturized in such a way that the captain appeared almost comical, despite the great purpose with which he moved, that the rubber baron's anger, his shouting, his red face were the nearly soundless ministrations of a mite moving across the surface of a much larger animal. Trees, birds, the exhalation of the passing mass of water. And thus there was not much to what they did now, as hours passed and she heard giggling and then moans of pleasure from within Kacheri's home, the low gurgle and hum of the Amazon River, the tracking of the sun. Her lips parted and she periodically wiped from her brow the sweat gathered there, tasted the salt of herself and found it wanting. A jaguar at some point emerged from the jungle. The toes of the creature splayed silently with its deliberate steps. She could almost feel the heat of the predator, the silent strength contained in its powerful jaws. Still, this idea that they were shrunk did not dissipate, even as the jaguar slunk towards her. The captain shouted and placed his body between Imelda and the jaguar. It opened its mouth, and she was close enough she could make out the shape of its teeth. She could see the long tongue. Its roar sounded like a deep cough. The beast was lustrous, a regal purple that exuded rather than inhaled the light. The captain pulled the gun from his shirt coat pocket and aimed at the cat, but before he could fire, the visitor appeared and stepped between them. The visitor crouched and extended his hands, palms up, in the direction of the shiny jaguar. The jaguar rolled over, and the visitor walked over, scratched its belly, and then patted it on the back of the neck. It walked away into the jungle. The visitor pulled a pipe from a pocket of his multicolored jacket and began exhaling rings of smoke. He sat on the ground and encouraged the others to join him.
"I think you should rest for a while. Consider your lives. Ponder the vastness of time. Experience a quiet that you have likely never had. It's safe here. Nothing will happen to you, or at least it is quite unlikely any ill will befall you here. And if it does, this is also something to think about. The line between these things, which side means something. Kacheri has told me that she is happy to host you, that you can stay as long as you like. Eat fish broth," said the visitor.
"We go," said the captain.
"I would counsel against this, but you must do what suits you best," said the visitor.
"I would like to return to civilization as soon as possible. Enough of this foolishness. Enough of this nonsense, this savage place," said the rubber baron.
"Savage, no. But we all have our preferences. And you, Imelda, will you go?"
said the visitor, turning to her. Imelda scooped a handful of sand and ran it across her fingers. The weight of the smells and the heat and the as-of-yet undissipated bundle of energy bore down upon her. The slowness, the incredible slowness of the place, would cement her here forever if she did not make an effort. It was appealing, but she could also not bring herself to commit to this just yet.
"I will go as well," Imelda said. "I am disappointed that you will not stay with us longer, but I wish you nothing but good luck," said the visitor.
He sat on the ground and played his flute while they prepared for the journey. They placed bundles of food and a gourd of fresh water into the boat. The captain removed his pistol from his shirt coat pocket and examined the barrel. Imelda transferred sand from one hand to the other, then to the ground. By the time they were ready to leave, she had created a mound half a meter in height. It would crumble shortly, she knew. But all the same, she was proud of her work and mindful that only the scale differed between the sand mound and everything else. The visitor and Kacheri stood on the shore and waved to them as they pushed through the water. The porter immediately fell asleep.
"Where are we going?" the rubber baron asked.
"Salt. Ships come more frequently there," said the captain.
Imelda dipped her fingers into the water and languidly twirled her digits. There was a direct line between the tip of her finger and the swirl of fish below. The thin bones alike, cells alike, blood alike, dreams of water alike. Even if there was no way she could ever hope to surface this connection, their glimmer of scales, their appetites, their movement through occluded waters was similar. They were there, somewhere, even if she couldn't see them. Even if they would potentially shred the flesh from her skeleton if given the opportunity, she could feel their vague electrical outputs and it put her at ease. A clutch of turtles splayed on the nearby bank.
"How well do you know this area?" asked Imelda.
"Well enough," said the captain.
One part like another, as far as she could tell, the oar breaking through the water, the birds breaking through the canopy. The captain rowed, the porter slept, the rubber baron sweated.
"Where are the other boats? Why are there no other boats? Isn't this a popular route?"
asked the rubber baron.
"It is, yes," said the captain. "So why have we not seen another living person? Where is our boat? What is with this visitor?" asked the rubber baron.
"I do not know," said the captain.
Roughly 1 hour after leaving the village, the captain began struggling with the oars. His face grew red with the exertion. The great muscles in his forearms strained. Imelda could discern no obvious reason for his struggle, as it did not appear the current had changed.
"What is it?" she asked.
The captain shook his head and continued with his attempt, but the boat had ceased moving. Ahead of them, the water was completely still, pitch black, and both banks of the river were covered in something that looked very much like ash. The captain pulled the oar from the water and examined it, finding a slick black substance dripping from the end of it.
"What is this?" asked the rubber baron.
"Don't know," said the captain.
A drip of the black substance fell from the oar onto the captain's hand. He pulled apart his fingers and the tar stretched between them. He wiped his fingers on his shirt, but the substance remained.
"Strange feeling," said the captain.
He wiped his hand against the side of the boat, but still the substance remained on his fingers. He drew a knife from his pants and began scraping the black from his fingers with the dull edge. After a great struggle, he managed to remove all traces of the viscous substance. After which, his fingers dropped off of his hand. There was no blood whatsoever. At the juncture, there was only a clean nub of flesh. The captain picked up his fingers, examined them dispassionately, and placed them into his pocket.
"A hell of a thing! That's a hell of a thing!" the rubber baron said.
The captain nodded. He rubbed the nubs, then gripped the oars once more.
"I don't think we'll be going this way," said the captain.
The porter stirred, raised an eyebrow at the captain's missing appendages, then resumed napping. They turned around and paddled back towards the village. Kachiri was waiting for them on the shore, but the visitor was nowhere to be seen. As they stepped off the boat, the captain's foot fell off. He picked it up and began hopping away from the water. Kachiri ran and fetched a large woven basket and pointed to the foot, then the opening of the basket. The captain placed his fingers and his foot within.
"Strange feeling," said the captain.
He vomited black bile. He then laid on his side, convulsed, and went still. Imelda placed her finger beneath his nose, felt that he was still breathing. They moved him into one of the dwellings. Kachiri covered him with a blanket. Night fell. Imelda lay in the dwelling with no roof and found a white point of light in the sky above to affix her place before closing her eyes. In the morning, it was discovered that both the captain's arms had fallen off. Imelda was the first to happen upon him, only discovering the separation when she poked the captain's chest with her finger and turned him on his side, which caused the arms to roll away from his body. The captain grumbled, vomited, and resumed his labored slumber. Imelda fetched Kachiri, and did her best to convey the captain's state with a detailed mime act. Kachiri nodded and began boiling tea. The captain stirred as Kachiri wafted tendrils of steam from the earthen container of tea beneath his nose. He looked down at his missing arms and his eyes went wide, at which point Kachiri stroked his ears and forced him to drink the tea. He grumbled, vomited, then resumed his labored slumber. Kachiri gathered his legs, tied them together with twine, and placed them on a mat made of grass and sticks, close enough that he could look at them and be comforted by their nearness if the urge came upon him. Given the vomiting and the not having arms, the captain was obviously in no condition to guide their watercraft, so Imelda, the rubber baron, and the porter decided that they would attempt the journey without him. They agreed that they would return for him. Imelda and the porter worked together to paddle while the rubber baron glared at the trees and the birds and the sky. After some hours of rowing and sweating, they came around a bend and found a series of docks jutting into the water. Beyond the docks, they could see numerous wooden shacks and other buildings.
"A rubber plantation," said the rubber baron.
"One of yours?" asked Imelda.
"No, no, don't know this place at all," said the rubber baron.
"We should disembark and see if anyone is around," said Imelda.
They tied the boat to one of the crumbling docks and walked towards the nearest shack. Within, they found tables, chairs.
"Do you hear that?" asked Imelda.
"Hear what?"
asked the rubber baron. They examined the buildings and the clearings.
"There is no one here. It looks like there hasn't been anyone here in a long time," the rubber baron said.
"Shall we continue our journey?" Imelda asked.
They rode through the Amazon, alternating the difficult labor between the three of them. Hours passed, and still they saw only trees and water. Darkness, complete, voiding everything beyond the canoe. After hours in darkness, at last a shape emerged. A crumbling dock.
"It cannot be, it cannot be," said the rubber baron.
It was the rubber plantation, the same as before.
"We'll have to put up here, I suppose," said the rubber baron.
They lit a fire, and the porter promptly fell asleep. Sometime later, Imelda rose, stirred by a buzz akin to the sound of insects, but far away and seeming to emanate from within her own skull at the same time as it trickled from the leaves of the trees. It caused her fingers to vibrate, her teeth to shake. Her eyeballs flicked back and forth. Imelda walked deeper into the abandoned plantation. Neither the porter nor the rubber baron had made any move to stop her. She reached a clearing where shoots were just beginning to poke through the dirt. A stockade in the middle, the metal rusty.
"Who's there?"
Imelda asked, but there were only patches of dirt and empty buildings. The buzz intensified. Her stomach began to squirm.
"And where have you been? Where have you been?"
asked the stockade in a voice very much like her own.
"Iquitos," she answered.
"And where? And where? And where?"
"Iquitos. Always Iquitos," Imelda answered to the nearest patch of ground which held perfectly preserved footprint of one of those who had worked to tap the trees.
"And why are you no longer there?"
A man knocking on the door.
"Your mother is dead."
She had never bothered to learn this man's name, the man who opened the door and served the drinks at the Ambassador Saloon. She knew him only by the sour milk smell of his sweat, the dirtiness of his fingernails. She knew him by the stories told by her mother that were like all other stories.
"Your mother is dead. There is no body," he said.
There was nowhere to go. The man opened the door, closed the door, and Iquitos whirled as before. Horses in the street, men with their mistresses and their prostitutes and their wives and some variation thereof.
"Your mother is dead. There is no body. She had no possessions worth bringing to you."
She was gone, of that Imelda was certain.
"And your mother was one of these, and also not one of these," said the grasses.
Said the empty buildings,
said the droning of the insects. She had dark hair, large, beautiful eyes, and when she thought Imelda could not hear her, she sang. Imelda found a tree with a metal faucet. She gripped the tap in front of her, and she saw the black liquid pouring where there should have been rubber.
"Where will you go, Imelda? When you leave here, where would you go?"
"There is nowhere to go," her mother had said.
"Somewhere else," she said,
and Imelda knew that it could never be true while her mother lived. Once, here, the plantation, the rubber poured from 1,000 taps, 1,000,000. The whip splits the flesh, the red oozes, turns black. When the brown-skinned workers tire, they are beaten. They die in their sleep, they die in the fields. They die running from the overseers. They die exhausted in a clump of dirt with rubber stuck to their fingertips. They die running from the slave catchers. They die young, everything of value extracted. They die. They die. They die. They die.
"Your mother is dead."
Imelda's mother never spoke of Imelda's father. Maybe he was the Spanish man. Maybe the man who smelled of sour milk. Maybe Bora with the beautiful brown skin.
"Did you ever try to find us here?" asked the black ooze pouring from the tap of the tree.
"Did you ever wonder what stirred all the horses in Iquitos? What moved the men to their whorehouses? What helped fill up the banks with notes?"
"I did not."
A jaguar, a turtle, a fish, a crocodile, a moon, a river that traversed between jungles, swollen with the bodies of the living and the dead. They came with torches and guns, and they came with chains. When their bodies were exhausted, when they dried up as the trees dried of rubber, they were returned to the river or to the earth. Imelda traced the outline of the footprint with her fingertips. In the morning, the sun rose. They returned to the village. Kachiri was standing on a shore with a grim expression on her face. Imelda followed after her and found the captain, reduced to a stub. Kachiri had tied together his legs and placed them onto the same mat which held his arms. The captain gazed at his limbs longingly. Imelda sat down on the ground near the entrance. Moments later, the rubber baron huffed into the dwelling, followed by the porter, who found a comfortable corner to nap in.
"A hell of a thing that's happened to you," said the rubber baron.
"Unfortunate.
Unfortunate," the captain repeated.
"We weren't able to find a route away from here," said the rubber baron.
"Unfortunate.
Unfortunate," the captain said.
Kachiri cradled his head, poured tea into his mouth.
"Warm,"
the captain said. He smiled. Then his head fell from his body, and he was quiet. Kachiri placed his head into a purple basket, then covered it with leaves.
"Are we not going to bury him?"
asked the rubber baron. Before an answer was produced, the citrus notes of the visitor's flute drifted in from the direction of the river.
Oh my, what has become of him?"
asked the visitor upon viewing the captain's disassembled state.
"We tried to leave this savage place and came across some sort of sludge in the water. A bit of it dripped onto him, and now, well, you see, he's falling apart," said the rubber baron.
The porter continued to sleep. The visitor reached within his coat and pulled out a gourd, from which he produced a green paste. He mixed the green paste with some dirt, as well as some fish bones, and placed it on a metal container into which he brought to a boil over the cooking fire outside. He whispered something over the container, sang a short song, and then allowed the mixture to cool. The visitor removed the captain's head from the purple basket, untied his legs and arms, and applied the greenish paste to all points of detachment, humming all the while.
"This may take a while," said the visitor.
While they waited, the visitor played his flute. The rubber baron walked in angry circles. Imelda started to build another mound of sand. The captain's eyes opened.
The captain rubbed his eyes as if he had just awoken from a nap.
Unfortunate. Unfortunate. Unfortunate, the captain said.
The visitor clapped his hands together exultantly.
Success! This doesn't always work, you know. And sometimes it takes weeks or years, and by that point you don't really want it to work. What luck we're having!
The captain glanced around. He stood up, and the visitor clapped his hands together in delight once more.
Splendid! His progress is nothing short of incredible, the visitor said.
The captain walked towards the porter and reached his hand into his stomach, pulling out his intestines. The porter sat up and began screaming. The rubber baron staggered away from the scene of violence and the smell of spilled entrails, ashen. Kachiri registered no change.
Oh, oh, oh,
said the visitor. The captain continued pulling on the intestines of the porter as if they were holiday ribbons on a gift. The visitor pulled from his coat a knife, stepped toward the two men, and then drew the blade across the captain's neck, once more disconnecting his head from his body. The visitor placed the captain's head on the ground and moved his corpse from atop the porter. The visitor whispered something in the porter's ear. The porter nodded. The visitor then stabbed the porter in the heart, and he too was still. The visitor wiped his blade on the porter's sleeve and then returned it to his coat.
Sometimes these things happen, the visitor said.
The rubber baron began shouting in the visitor's face.
What is this? What is the meaning of this? I told you to stay here and find your own meaning. Sometimes there is no meaning. I don't know what to tell you, said the visitor.
The rubber baron, a bulbous onion man, puffed himself up and pushed against the visitor with his protruding belly. The visitor laughed, twirled as if confronting an angry bull.
Please, my good sir, I did all that I could.
It's been nothing but riddles and nonsense since we arrived here. Our boat, this black tar, your ridiculous potions and nonsensical answers. I can't stand it anymore, said the rubber baron.
The rubber baron drew back his hand and then slapped the visitor. The visitor ducked, but the rubber baron's hand caught the tip of his hat, which drifted to the ground. The visitor raised his hands to cover his head, but it was too late. They had all seen what was beneath the hat. An orifice, flexing, opening, pink and wet. It was a blowhole.
What is this? What is the meaning of this?
The rubber baron shouted, began shaking. The visitor picked up his hat off the ground, dusted it off, and placed it back on his head.
Sometimes there is no explanation. That's the explanation.
What is happening?
The next series of events happened so quickly that Imelda perceived them only in fragments. The rubber baron moved to the corpse of the captain, began rummaging in his pockets. The visitor fell as a gunshot rang out. Kachiri screamed. The rubber baron held the pistol in the air, shouting,
"What is this? What is the meaning of this?"
Imelda pulled the metal container from its place over the cooking fire.
"What is this? What is the meaning of this?"
The first strike was sufficient. The rubber baron fell to the ground. The back of his skull caved in. Though the first strike was sufficient, Imelda did not stop then. Did not stop until her arms were too tired to swing anymore. Imelda sat. Kachiri sat next to her. They built a mound of the bloodied sand. Sometime later, a jaguar emerged from the jungle. It licked her, its breath hot on her face, the strength of it. It did not stop until she was cleaned of the gore from what had once been the rubber baron. Its breath smelled of earth and trees and blood. Its tongue was warm and scratchy, and she lay down and allowed it to clean her completely. When the jaguar finished, it grabbed the rubber baron's body and dragged it away into the jungle. Imelda reached out to Kachiri and helped her to her feet. Kachiri and Imelda dragged the body of the captain and the porter to the edge of the river, then pushed them into the water. The visitor's body they moved into Kachiri's dwelling. He was still warm. Imelda stayed with Kachiri for 7 days, helping her to bring broth to a boil. helping her to sweep the dirt from the floor of her dwelling. The visitor's body remained in the dwelling with them, never growing cold, never rotting. At night, Imelda stared to the sky, affixing herself to a single white point. On the morning of the seventh day, Kachiri went into labor. For 7 hours, Kachiri screamed. For 7 hours, she writhed. For 7 hours, Imelda gritted her teeth as Kachiri dug her fingernails into the soft flesh of her hand. At last, something broke. Imelda stepped back as she saw the shiny pink-gray flesh. Then she helped pull a baby dolphin from Kachiri's slick body. Kachiri held aloft the squirming animal, its tail flipping back and forth.
"My boy," said Kachiri. "My beautiful boy."
Imelda understood her perfectly, though she was still speaking in her native tongue.
"He is beautiful," Imelda responded. "We must get him into the water," Kachiri said.
They walked together to the banks and then placed the small pink-gray boy into the waters of the Amazon. The tiny dolphin jumped from the water joyfully before disappearing beneath the surface and swimming away. When they returned to the dwelling, the visitor's belongings were neatly arranged in a pile where his body had once been.
"He is gone then," said Kachiri.
"Yes and no," said Imelda.
"What do you mean?"
"I mean that there are many places to go and many ways to get there, that is all," said Imelda.
And Kachiri laughed, and Imelda laughed with her. They embraced, and Imelda ran her fingers through Kachiri's dark hair, still sweaty and clumped. Imelda reached into the visitor's coat and removed the small gourd. She dipped her fingers within, removing the green paste. She sniffed the tips of her fingers. It was her mother's brown skin. It was tangled roots and water gurgling. She tasted the green paste. It was salty. It was flesh and sun. She slathered the green paste on her fingertips, which moved across her flesh, making circles on her body, moving towards the glistening folds of her sex. She made no attempt to suppress the shudder that passed through her body as she did so. When she was done, she opened her eyes to find Kachiri standing expectantly by the entryway. Imelda placed her hands on Kachiri's shoulders. Kachiri's eyes opened wide, her lips parted.
"Will you return to me?"
asked Kachiri. "I will, my everything," she said. She kissed Kachiri on her forehead. Kachiri smiled. Imelda placed the hat upon her head. She picked up the colorful coat, placing it over her shoulders. The whispering of jaguar tongues and turtle shells tickling her back. She and Kachiri walked hand in hand to the shore of the powerful vein of water. The boat draped in colorful flags at the ready. She stood on the bow, and the boat stirred beneath her and began to move. She removed from the jacket pocket the flute and began playing as around her the jungle flickered. The river carried her anywhere. The end. Well, that was an interesting one. My thanks to Corey Hill, and thank you for listening. Please make sure to like and subscribe and follow us on social media. Until next time, this has been the Storytime Broadcast. Thanks.